Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Culture Heritage Fund. Live from the University of Minnesota, you are listening to Culture Q, the Twin Cities arts and cultural program providing you the stories of Minnesota that you won't hear anywhere else. I'm your host, Matt Curtis, and thank you so much for joining us. Tonight, we're getting creative. Not with macaroni pitchers and paper mache, but something more, you know, more talented. You know, with the talented minds of the Twin Cities, breaking the mold in the creative fields of work. Kitty talks to a musician that is separating himself from the crowd. Parker Lemke finds out what it takes to be a craftsman, and Nathan Gurdis discovers the origins of a genre. And it starts right now on Radio K's Culture Q.
I mean, I see my friends and people that I look up to or that I respect, that I want to see grow, and they will spend a year and a half working on 12 or 13 songs, and then, you know, there's 2 months beforehand to get really good attention, and then the album drops and you get another month of attention, and then that was it.
A Bigfoot that lived in the woods by our house, and we almost caught him a few times, but he's pretty quick. But yeah, we had nunchucks and big spears that we'd make out of old hockey sticks, and yeah, he.
You may have heard of Botsy from going to see a show somewhere in Minneapolis, or from the cover of Vita.mn, where he was recently a top 5 finalist in the RU Local contest. But he's not just a local performer. Producer Katie Bolin caught up with Botsy to discuss a creative project that sets him apart from the rest of the music industry.
I am a MC as well as an organizer and a curator of events and artists.
Botsy says his artist collective, Polka Dot Mayhem, is hard to explain.
When we conceptualized it, we didn't want to define it right out the gate. Rather than saying what we were, we wanted to show people what we were. That at the core of it, we're a project-based label.
Being a project-based label means that Polka Dot Mayhem is stepping away from the model of a traditional record label.
I mean, it's a dying business model.
Instead, they are focusing more on a larger vision of artistic projects. They aim to innovate art in ways that have a deeper connection to how we interact with music and art in our modern tech-obsessed world.
Do you think the public or the consumer needs, like, they need to be kind of grabbed to pay attention to music? Because it's something we listen to every day on the radio, on our iPods, on our phones.
We live in such a weird time right now, in the essence of, like, the rate of consumption right now is absurd. I myself putting out 3-4 EPs in 3 months is basically what it's been now. And that's just, again, that's a thing that I, you know, a lot of people be like, you're not supposed to do that. But I just look at everything right now, and I mean, I see my friends and people that I look up to or that I respect, that I want to see grow, and they will spend a year and a half working on 12 or 13 songs, and then, you know, there's 2 months beforehand and get really good attention, and then the album drops and you get another month of attention, and then that was it. And then we go back to the drawing board.
Recognizing a disconnect between time spent creating an album by the artist and time spent consuming said album, Botsy suggests a new approach for artists.
I think a lot of people, we live in a time where artists are looking at this almost entirely as a career and forgetting that, like, we just make music. And if we start making music at the rate that people are consuming it, which is hard to do, but if we kind of make that our priority rather than a new music video, then I think that that'll be the advantage. And also,
not only does the modern tech-savvy music lover's rate of consumption affect how artists create, but it also affects how artists make use of emerging technological trends to target new listeners. Jellyfish Brigade is one artist that is currently working on an innovative project with Polka Dot Mayhem.
Jellyfish Brigade.
For their record, they're based out of Portland, and the majority of the music was written in public places. So we're actually going to do art installments, physical art installments, at the places where these songs were created, with lyrics and a scannable code to stream a song right there on the spot. Rather than just take a record and release it, we want to come up with creative ways, and that was that whole thing derived from listening to the artist and how they created it, and then brainstorming afterwards.
With a collective like Polka Dot Mayhem working to spread his art, Lucas Dix, the MC of Jellyfish Brigade, knows how vital their help really is.
I think the biggest struggle that I face as an independent artist is the ability to find time to create and then to find time and resources to put the projects out and release them into the world.
Like many modern day artists, Lucas doesn't make his living solely on the music he helps create.
I'm a full-time sixth grade language arts teacher, and I'm also a full-time student in a master's program. So I don't necessarily have a lot of time to make music or time to put out music.
Is it important for independent artists to be a part of a collective?
Yeah, I definitely think so. And I don't really know anybody who is amazing at making music, is amazing at shooting music videos, is amazing at website development, is great at doing press releases and all this other type of stuff. So it's really important to have a good group of people like Polka Dot Mayhem for us, where my buddy Jeff makes the music and then I wrote the rhymes and Jeff recorded me, and then we can give it to Polka Dot Mayhem and they're like, hey, we have somebody who likes to do video footage, and we have someone who does art design, and Foxy can design websites. You just have this collective where you guys kind of get to barter with each other.
Having access to various artists with different talents through a group like Polka Dot Mayhem is key when it comes to networking in the music world.
Someone shoots a music video, one of your homies shoots a music video for you for free, and then someone else likes it, and they want to like, hey, I want you to shoot my music video. And then the people who saw the music video are like, the music video maker's friends are like, oh man, that artist is dope. I want him to do something for me. So you just kind of all build each other up, and you support each other, and eventually, hopefully, everybody is kind of winning at the end and is able to express themselves and promote their art in a proper way.
Although artist collectives have existed in the past, groups like Polka Dot Mayhem stand to reinvent what they mean for artists who work in the struggling music industry. Botsy attributes the success of Polka Dot Mayhem to faithfully straying from the norm.
Always try and throw something different in there and just make people rethink what they're doing. So many people, big businesses, small businesses, big artists, small artists, and humans in general are just doing the same thing over and over again and not really asking why. So our goal is to just make everybody rethink a little bit.
For Culture Q, I'm Katie Bolin.
This weekend, the American Craft Council held a major event, celebrating for all 3 days all things handmade at the St. Paul River Center. Culture Q reporter Parker Lemke visited Joel Nichols, an artist featured in this year's show, to learn how his custom furniture and home accessory business has fared as a part of the Twin Cities' thriving crafts market. You and I were born.
Joel Nichols grew up playing in his father's carpentry workshop, never knowing it would one day lead to the successful furniture business he operates from his home in Stillwater today.
I just would goof around, me and my friends would be, playing army or something, and we'd need some guns, so we'd go in the shop and make some toy guns.
And like all boys, he put his newfound skills to practical use.
There was a Bigfoot that lived in the woods by our house, and we almost caught him a few times, but he's pretty quick. But yeah, we had nunchucks and big spears that we'd make out of old hockey sticks, and yeah, he moved on, Bigfoot. We scared him out of the woods.
Following his Bigfoot hunting days, he studied business while attending college at River Falls.
My last semester, I had to take an art class to graduate. I needed an art credit, so I just signed up for this jewelry class, and I've never taken an art class before in my life. And I love the jewelry class. I love designing and making things, and I was pretty good at it.
He soon went into business for himself, starting in construction before moving on to work on furniture full-time around 2004. These days, he crafts just about anything out of wood, employing a mid-century modern aesthetic that uses clean lines to create sculptural curved pieces. I visited him at his workshop to see what he was preparing for the American Craft Council show, which took place this past weekend.
So this table, I got the wood from, It's a friend of mine, her friends were cutting down this maple tree, and it was full of burls, which are, you know, kind of ugly growths on the sides of trees. But you cut those open and you've got some of the most beautiful wood that you'll find.
Yeah, I definitely see like there, it has some nice like swirly patterns in it, like almost like ripples in water.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. It's just beautiful, different colors, and you know, it's amazing wood. It's kind of hard to work with, you know, cutting a sphere on a bandsaw, which is probably the most dangerous thing you can do, because the you know, you can easily lose fingers doing it. But
have you had any unfortunate accidents yet?
Not major ones. I've nicked myself a couple of times, broken blades, and you see all the dents in my door over there from the kickbacks on the table saw.
The American Craft Council, headquartered in the Twin Cities since 2010, was founded in 1941 as a marketplace for artists. Its 2014 event in St. Paul featured 240 of them from across the country, including 80 local ones, according to American Craft Council Director of Marketing and Communications, Pamela Diamond, who explained that craftsmen like Joel Nichols have to put forward exceptional utilitarian work to be selected to take part.
They are judged by peers. There's a jury each year. So he's in the furniture and lighting category, so there would be experts in that field that would look at all the work that's submitted in that category, and they just select the best of the best, and then they're invited to be in the show. So you've got to keep the work fresh. The craftsmanship has to be exemplary. It has to be, you know, on trend, that, you know, things that people really resonate with in the here and now. So I think Joel's work, I like that you selected him, because I think, you know, he hits it on all those fronts.
For Joel Nichols, marketplace environments like the American Craft Council show are ideal places to spread interest in his work.
Because, you know, a lot of the stuff that I have that I bring to shows, I may not sell it at the show, but somebody will want. I mean, I've got one bench I've sold three times. Somebody, they like it, but, oh, I need it 4 inches longer and 1 inch higher.
And the American Craft Council show is a particularly noteworthy event.
St. Paul is lucky to have that show, because they used to do more, and they kept the St. Paul show, which is a testament to the market that we have here and also some of the artists that we have here.
Although factory-produced products make up a significant percentage of the goods we use in our daily lives, Pamela Diamond says the market for handcrafted wares remains strong and is experiencing a renaissance.
Nice to have objects around your house that are not only useful but beautiful and have that human DNA in them. I don't know how to say it any better than that.
Joel Nichols makes his living crafting furniture with his own human DNA and has ambitious plans for the future.
I don't need a booming economy, but I need a healthy economy. And I think the economy is healthy now. I would like to have a bigger shop where I could hire one or two people. You know, there's just a lot of work that goes into a piece that I don't necessarily have to do. I could show somebody else how to do it, you know, because the business side of this does take a lot of time as well.
When working on a piece, Joel commonly cranks up the music on his radio to drown out the racket caused by his machines.
You know, you watch Norm Abram and shows like that, and you think, oh, it's glamorous working with the power tools. And I'm to the point where I hate turning on a machine, but I do it because I need the work done. But my favorite part is when I can, you know, use a spoke shave or the block plane or a rasp or a scraper. Or weaving is nice, because I can sit outside on my porch and weave a chair seat.
And he'd rather not have his children learn crafts the way he did as a boy.
I've got a 12 and a 14-year-old daughters, and I couldn't imagine turning them loose in this shop like my dad did when I was growing up.
For Culture Q, I am Parker Lemke.
In studio, we have today Parker Lemke, just fresh of his latest story. How you doing, man?
I'm doing fine.
Okay, so where did you get the inspiration to do this story? Like, what was going through your mind and you like, hey, I need to do a story on this?
Well, originally I got the press release from the American Craft Council, and I thought, okay, what could I do a story about this? Where's the thing? And I noticed in the text of the press release, in the email, it said there was a local artist in it, and I thought, hey, I'll just do a profile story on him and get, like, everyday citizen, just do a look at him and see what makes his life tick and how's he related to like that larger thing of like crafts and art in Minnesota.
Did it get you inspired to do some crafts and art yourself, or?
I do my plate's pretty much filled already doing stuff. I draw a little, and I guess that's the extent of that I have time for.
Is there anything that you wanted to get across in this story that you didn't quite manage to?
Well, I do have a regret that this story will be airing after that the American Craft Council show that's doing this weekend, and our show airs on Sunday night. So that's a tad disappointing. I wish I could have like scheduled it better, but I had my Spider-Man fan story to do last week, and I don't know, this is just how things go. I mean, I'm a student journalist, being a journalist and a student at the same time. It's not the most convenient setup, and we're pretty much working all the time on something or the other.
It's definitely hard life we live. All right, thank you so much, Park, for joining me, and great job on your story.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Matt.
Every week, Radio K selects one album to highlight, and this week we have selected Dissed and Dismissed by Tony Molina as our weekly release spotlight. I spoke to Radio K traffic director Gio Nikon about the record.
I'm Gio, I'm the traffic director at Radio K, and I reviewed this week's spotlight, which is Dissed and Dismissed by Tony Molina.
Great, and has this guy got like an interesting story? Like, what's going on here?
I think the most interesting thing that... The first interesting thing about this album to me was the fact that it was like under 12 minutes. Like, I added up all the track times and it added up to like 11 minutes and 42 seconds. And I noted that that was even less time than Perfect Pussy's set at the 7th Street entry.
That's pretty short.
Yeah, it's actually really short.
Do you feel like he got what he wanted to get across within these 11 minutes and 42 seconds?
I talk a lot about that in review, that like because of that short length, most of his tracks are, I believe, on average about 1 minute each. So he gets his ideas across very quickly, and before a guitar riff or at least a melody starts to get stale, he moves on to the next song. So everything still seems and sounds fresh.
And this is his debut album, I understand?
Yeah, it's his solo debut album, and it was re-released in CD form after the first pressing, which was released late last year, sold out very quickly. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so what kind of sound does he have?
I'd say that his he does that this album is basically a lot of short power pop. I had compared it to Guided by Voices in the review because of the short track length, and I guess the really great songwriting and melodies in his songs.
And what kind of themes does this album have?
Lyrically, his songs focus on broken relationships between girlfriends and other friends. I mean, there's a big reason why the album is called Dissed and Dismissed. Mm-hmm. Most of the songs in Dissed and Dismissed have a structure where it starts with probably, I guess, some guitar feedback, then Tony just dives straight into a verse or two, and after that is a short guitar solo, and after that is the end.
Yeah.
And I think that's actually a good summary of the whole album. Because it's short, it has a high replay value, and as I was listening to this album many times to write the review, I found that the album never really lost its power, and that the lyrics still packed punch.
Absolutely, and just like you were saying, like, before anything goes stale, he's on to the new song.
Yeah.
Excellent.
The first track of the album really set the lyrical theme for it, and it had one of the best lines, I believe, on the album because it's so relatable, and it's an anxiety that I'm pretty sure a lot of people can relate. The first track, I believe, is called Nowhere to Go, and the line that stuck with me most is, "All my friends, they like me more when I am not around."
And this is Nowhere to Go, the first track off the debut album of Tony Molina, Dissed and Dismissed, right here on Radio K's Culture Q. You can check out the full review on RadioK.org.
You gotta plan it on your own.
The word shoegaze has become a popular and common descriptor that is easy to forget, and that it refers to the distinct genre and to itself. Music reporter Nathan Gerst explores the importance and history of the scene that celebrates itself.
Imagine yourself in London, back in the early 90s. You hear a massively loud wall of noise emanating from a small club nearby, and you decide to check it out. Everyone in the club is a musician, and they're all staring intently at the band. The band is up on stage, rocking out, jumping around, and generally putting on a crazy, high-energy show. Wait, no, that's not right. The band is actually standing nearly motionless on stage with their heads down, focusing entirely on the music they're playing. Welcome to the world of shoegaze. You've probably heard this term before, especially if you're listening to college radio. But where does it come from? Why is it so important? And why has it proven itself so long-lasting? Shoegaze is one of the many genres that started branching off from the alternative rock movement in the mid-1980s. Bands like the Cocteau Twins and My Bloody Valentine took the unique, noisy sounds of alt-rock bands like Sonic Youth and Dinosaur Jr. and added dreamy textures with pop craftsmanship to create a unique sound. The result was a genre rooted in pop melodies but with an ethereal, opaque veneer. To this new breed of band, texture was king. There were no crazy guitar solos, only basic melodies. Rhythms were simple, repetitive, and kept the song centered. Even the vocals were often buried in the mix, adding melody but placing no importance on lyrics. This trend started with the Cocteau Twins, whose vocalist Elizabeth Fraser often chose to sing incomprehensible or meaningless lyrics, preferring to use her voice as just another melodic instrument. Another main pioneer of shoegaze was Irish band My Bloody Valentine. Guitarist Kevin Shields utilized open guitar tunings, custom guitar equipment, and a seemingly infinite number of guitar effects in order to help create the band and the genre's uniquely dreamy and all-encompassing guitar sound. The band only released two albums in their original life cycle, but 1988's Isn't Anything and 1991's Loveless are still regarded as two of the most important and influential alt-rock albums of all time, thanks in part to their help in creating and defining shoegaze as a unique subgenre. First wave of shoegaze bands pushed into the early 90s, more and more bands began to apply and refine their style. Artists like Slowdive and Lush came out of the London shoegaze and Britpop scene, a relatively small subculture of musicians that came to be known as the scene that celebrates itself, due to the community's tendency to focus on cooperation instead of rivalry. The name shoegaze also came out of this London scene, being used in reference to a concert by the band Moose, whose vocalist would read lyrics taped to the floor. This phrase evolved to refer to bands that spent their entire show staring at their effects pedals, electing to concentrate more on finding the perfect guitar tone than in interacting with the audience. As the music and community developed, the intensity of the genre led many to view the scene as pretentious and self-absorbed, My Bloody Valentine reportedly spent $250,000 recording their album Loveless, nearly bankrupting their record label and getting them dumped despite massive critical acclaim. In the mid-90s, shoegaze began to fall out of style in favor of Britpop, grunge, and indie rock, but found itself in a resurgence in the new millennium, especially in the United States. Bands such as Asobi Sexu, Silver Sun Pickups, and My Vitriol revived the style. In addition, in the last decade, shoegaze has seen crossovers with countless other different styles of music, serving as an important influence to post-rock, electronic music, and punk musicians. With My Bloody Valentine putting out their first new album in over 20 years in 2013, and bands as diverse as Weekend and shoegaze metalheads Def Heaven putting out universally beloved albums, to this day, shoegaze lives on as a strong influencing factor in modern underground music. For Culture Cube, I'm Nathan Gertis.
You've been listening to Culture Cube on Radio K, airing every Sunday at 6 p.m, bringing you all the stories from the Twin Cities you won't hear anywhere else. Tonight you heard the voices of Matt Curtis, Parker Lemke, and Amy Friedman. Our producers are Amy Friedman, Parker Lemke, and Kate Bolin. Our music reporter is Nathan Gerdes. Our culture coach is Sarah Lemanchek. And I'm Matt Curtis. You can find us on RadioK.org, PRX, and iTunes. Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. See you next Sunday at 6 p.m. And thank you for listening.